Hello, this is Jeremy Schwartz, and this is Saving Tomorrow's Planet, the podcast that goes around the world finding people who are taking real action to save the planet. And today we have an incredibly special guest from the Philippines, A.G. Sano. You will hear why he calls himself A.G. through the discussion. And you know what I love about this podcast and doing these discussions is that you meet people who truly move you to action, move you emotionally. And when you hear the values of AJ and his mentors, I think you will be as moved as I was and hopefully moved to take action as he is taking. Here's a man who is passionate about the wildlife, particularly the whales and the dolphins of the world, and also a passionate artist and photographer. And you will hear just the most inspiring story, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I have. Let's start by finding out where AG is at the moment of our discussion.
All right, everyone calls me AG. It actually stands for Amado Guerrero. That's Spanish for beloved warrior.
Oh, wow.
But over the years, I realized it's more apt to say Arcobaleno Guerrero, which means rainbow warrior.
Oh,
I've been a big fan of the rainbow warriorship for many years. Somebody, like a good friend from Italy, told me, why not use rainbow warrior now instead of beloved warrior? So I've been doing street art for many years now, I think 14 years now, mostly about the environment. So I've been traveling the world doing that. Right now I'm in a city called Mandaue. It's in the island of Cebu in the Philippines. We have done a lot of murals here about climate justice, about indigenous people, about marine environments. But I would accredit or attribute my advocacy to my father's really old camera. So I found this camera many years ago. I think that was in 1998 to be exact. And you know, I haven't used it for a long time. I had it cleaned by a technician, then started taking pictures. I was able to try out a lot of different types of photography, but I fell in love with nature photography. So I applied photographer for WWF in 1999. Just got out of college that time, and I was accepted to be part of the first ever humpback whale research in the Philippines as a photographer. So spent hours and hours at sea, many months at sea during the summers. For 7 consecutive summers, we documented the migrating humpback whales, and some of them comes from as far as the Bering Sea.
Wow.
And we found out about that because of our photographs, taking pictures of the underside of the tails, or what we call flukes. We're able to catalog them and then compare them to the catalogs of Japanese researchers and even researchers from Russia, I believe. And so we were able to find out where some of them actually travels. And that made me fall in love with Mother Nature, spending time with them, watching their behaviors, learning about how marine mammals live. And so that's how I actually got into conservation work. Then I found myself doing other conservation work for sharks, for dugongs, and other concerns that WWF and other NGOs that are working on the field in the Philippines.
Right.
But in, so that's how I actually got into conservation and environmental work.
Oh, that's fascinating. Let's go back to the whales. I'd like to start there because, you know, we always imagine that you would have sonars or something, you know, in order to track a whale. But you're saying you can actually photograph the underside and you can see markings, is it? I can imagine there are scratches or specific things.
Yeah, those are exactly right. They have markings, scratches sometimes a rake marks by probably killer whales or even sharks. Sometimes round marks, maybe by a cookie cutter shark. And that's how we determine who they are. It makes them distinct from other individuals. And when we take the photograph as they dive, we keep them, we catalog them, as I said, and that's how we find out.
Sorry, now you're wearing a wetsuit. Are you in the water with them? Is that, or you were sitting
We're sitting on a boat waiting for them for hours. Sometimes we try to manually, quote unquote, triangulate where they are using hydrophones.
Yeah.
So we also record their songs, and that's how we find out if their whales in the vicinity. And then sometimes if the sound is weak, we try to go out further at sea. And if the sound gets stronger, that means we're getting close. If it gets weaker, then we went to the wrong direction. It's pretty much what we call a third world research. So we make do of what we have. Yeah, with the first ever trip we had in the summer of year 2000, there were seven of us, and none of us has even seen a whale, like a humpback whale, in our lives. And it was also us who actually formulated the research forms that we had to fill up. Everything was from scratch. And it was quite an experience for most of us in that first trip ever.
Now, I'm going to be a bit challenging, naughty here, because you mentioned that the Japanese were also documenting. Now, our view of the Japanese and whales is more that they have a desire to kill them, if we're honest. So that's more so than perhaps doing research and documenting. I know they claim that they are killing for research, but just give us a little story as to, because it's not a black and white statement, is it? And what's their interest and why?
Yeah, that's actually the perfect question for someone like me who's doing art for the whales, for the dolphins. And the reason why I actually did my several murals the past several years is because I wanted to show the world, especially Filipinos, how beautiful they are and how that we should care for them. And that was sparked by a movie that I saw in, I think, 2010.
Right.
It's called The Cove. And the Cove movie actually showed how they're slaughtered by the Japanese.
Yeah.
And researching about it the past 12 years, I learned Japan is a big country. They have millions and millions of people, and they don't actually think the same.
So
we work with scientists actually know the value and importance of whales in the environment and marine ecosystem. They know that they should care for and conserve the whales and their habitats. But on the other hand, you have traditionalists in just a small town in Taiji.
Yeah.
Who believes that they're entitled to actually kill whales and still eat them, make money out of them. And there's also actually the national government who believes in that also. So there are different types of Japanese. We work with Japanese who are in the academe, believe in the same thing that we believe in. We view whales the same way we do. Then, like I said, the problem is there are other, actually just a minority of the population who believes that they still need to kill whales to preserve the tradition.
Yeah.
So that's a thin line to tread on.
Yeah. And I'm glad you said that, because of course that's what I have assumed too. We know how sophisticated, cultured, and respectful the Japanese are as a culture, and therefore I'm sure it is just a minority or a certain culture or a certain place. And we see that also with that slaughter of those dolphins. It's a very particular place, so we must be careful not to use a brush across the whole population, which you've done so carefully. I would like to explore some more here in terms of first of all, actually, I didn't know that the Philippines had whales passing in that direction. I've never read anything or heard anything. So do you wonder, is there some background to why whales are in your waters?
Yeah, actually, when we did it we did the first trip in the year 2000, or when the team was being formed in 99, nobody actually knew in the scientific community globally that they actually travel here. But when we went to the islands north, went to the locals in the islands, we learned. We discovered that even their grandfathers had been telling stories to them about the whales, about their experience with the whales when they go out fishing during summer months. They would see the whales, they would enjoy looking at them, like sprinkling like a big fountain. They call the blow of a whale a fountain in the ocean. So it's amazing how these people have known and have lived harmoniously with the whales up north in the Philippines. But nobody knew about it outside of those islands. Yeah, so that's amazing. And I think it was a breakthrough for WWF to actually find time or have an effort to study them. But also when I found out about how they discovered the whales there, it was also quite amazing, because there was this private island, just a small private island with the fisher folks.
Right.
They would dive at night to catch fish. And one night they were perplexed because there was a loud surround sound coming from everywhere. It was like a singing ghost. So they thought it was a ghost at first, like underwater ghost. So they had to find out about it. And incidentally, there was a volunteer of WWF. So he went to that island to dive with the owner of the island. Then the fisher folks asked him, because they knew he was an environmentalist. So they asked him, is there a fish or any creature in the sea that sinks or emits a loud sound. And immediately he thought, oh, that could be a humpback whale. So then they described how it sounded like they tried to imitate. And he was really sure that it was a humpback whale, just with the description of the sound. And that's how it started when WWF thought, oh, maybe you should take a look at that because it's important to establish marine protected zones if there are indeed whale habitats there, especially migrating humpback whales, because no one knew that before.
And you mentioned just at the beginning the word indigenous people. I'm very, very interested in the indigenous people that are, you know, in different parts of the world and the knowledge they have about, you know, how to be more sustainable and so on. So these people you're talking about are indigenous people on those islands or not?
Yeah, in the extreme north, we have two groups of islands. The first one, or the northernmost one, which is actually closer to Taiwan than the Philippines, is called Batanes Group. There are indigenous people there. There are actually studies that believe that they're more connected to the southerners of Taiwan rather than the Philippines because they have the same dialect, actually, just a little bit of variation. But they can understand each other using their language there. So they're indigenous. But the second part, what we call the Babuyan Group of Islands, was inhabited by the people from the biggest island of the Philippines called Luzon. They're not indigenous anymore, but they're locals there. They have their own language there. And these are the people that I mentioned earlier that have been living harmoniously with these whales, not even knowing how special those giant creatures are.
Amazing. Now, you obviously are doing these murals and you indicated that. Do you want to tell me how did you decide to go into this area? And I need to reveal to you that I was the CEO of the Body Shop. And when I wanted to relaunch the company's commitment to sustainability, I got commissioned murals also around the world. I have to admit that as fantastic as they were, we didn't really get the sort of Instagram and social media coverage that we were hoping. But so I have also a stake in the idea about murals, and that's why I was very interested to talk to you. But perhaps start with, you know, what inspired you, and then how have you got this fantastic talent for painting? Because I have to say they're very beautiful.
First of all, thanks for that kind comment. I've been doing art since I was 10. I discovered that my love for art when I was in the fourth grade. And when my mother knew about it, she made sure that gets enhanced. So she found a mentor for me who became like a father figure also, mm-hmm. who mentored me for many, many years. But what sparked my idea or my passion to do those marine mammal murals? So when I saw the movie The Cove, like I mentioned earlier,
yes,
with Rick O'Barry as the central figure of the documentary. Yeah, at the end of the film, there was a challenge that says that the slaughters would continue if we don't do anything about it. And it sparked the passion in me to do something about it. And as an artist, my instinct was to paint a wall.
Right.
And the very next day after watching the movie, the documentary, I found a wall. I knocked on a wall of a missionary. So I was there in the Babuyan Islands, actually studying those whales in 2010 when I watched the movie. Then I tried to look for some paint because those islands are really remote. I had to look for like leftover paints from some construction site. And there were quite a few. And we were able to fill up a couple of walls. I still have a photograph of those walls, and I consider them the first dolphin wall. That's what we call it.
You must send those pictures to me. I'd like to post them if you would.
I would, sure. And what's interesting is that when I got back to Manila with my team, I posted on Facebook that I'm going to paint one dolphin for every dolphin that they capture in Japan. And a lot of people, there. I think back then, we don't have the concept of viral post yet. That was a long time ago.
Oh.
A lot of people from my network responded positively, but nobody wanted their walls to be painted with dolphins. I mean, it sounded weird. You know, when I asked if you have a wall, I'm going to paint a dolphin. So it sounded weird. Nobody wanted it. So there's this good friend of mine, also an environmentalist. He used to be a crew member of a Greenpeace boat. And he told me, okay, I have a store in the village. Why don't you paint the wall just for you to start? So what I did was I took a time-lapse video of that. And then I sent the video of the first wall in the islands and that video in the village in Manila. Sent it to CNN. sent it without any, you know, expectations. And I was surprised when a producer for CNN International sent me an email and told me that they wanted to carry the story. And they asked if I could have an interview with them on Skype. But there was no Zoom yet that time.
Yeah.
And I said, of course, I'd be happy to do the interview. It'll be a milestone for the campaign. And so what I did was I made sure that I had my phone with me. I slept at around 11 p.m. And the producer was in the U.S. I think around 3 a.m. was the schedule of the call. But when I woke up, it was nice and sunny already. And I thought, wow, I missed the call. Then when I checked my phone, I had a lot of missed calls from my U.S. number.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I said, I missed the chance. I checked my email and then they said, hey, I've been calling you. Nobody was angry. But what we can do is we'll send you the questions and record yourself answering those questions as if we're doing their interview.
Right.
They're really good. They edited it perfectly. That's what I did. And it came out like one whole week, 7 days on CNN International. I think five times a day. Played five times a day, the videos and all, and the interview. And that's when people, like, messages poured in. My email, my Facebook was crazy. And a lot of people were sending their messages of support. And then a lot of people wanted their walls to be painted on.
Oh, right.
And that's how I started. So we started painting in 2010. Believe it or not, we haven't stopped yet.
Wow.
Until now. Until now.
And are you going around the world painting or just in Philippines?
Yeah, we have. I had invitations from many countries, but I was only able to do about 16 countries.
Well, that's quite a lot, I have to say.
It's quite a lot, actually. Yeah.
How many wall or murals have you done then?
We're working on wall number 1004 now.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, but what's interesting, Jeremy, is wall number 1000. I was monitoring the number of walls. Then we were down to just a few to hit 1000. And incidentally, had an event in Bali, Indonesia for the G20 summit. Just last November. Yeah, so 350.org helped me out, supported me in that trip. We were supposed to do some art actions, but we were not allowed because of security concerns from the Indonesian government. But anyway, I was able to connect to the group of Rick O'Barry. Because incidentally, Rick and his team, after the doing the Cove movie, they continued doing their dolphin advocacy, and they actually started a rescue operation and rehabilitation in Bali, Indonesia.
Right.
And I was able to paint mural 1000 on the wall of their home base, and they call it the Dolphin Project. And it happened, and everything fell into the right place. We were able to do a dolphin wall there, and we painted the three dolphins that they just released.
Oh, wow.
Into the wild like a month earlier. Yeah, so it was like a full circle for me doing the murals.
You know, what we are, you hinted at the beginning, and it's funny, I've just been on a conversation with somebody I'm working with, Kantar, where I'm the chairman of their sustainability practice, about activism and the role that activism can or can't play, or its effectiveness at changing opinions. So tell me, you know, is there another story you have around activism? Which you may be saying is what your murals are, a sort of a permanent message, and but not a one that's so as disruptive as, let's say, gluing yourself to something which may or may not be good. So what's your story around this? Sounds interesting.
Yeah, the beauty of art is that, especially public art, is that the message will be there even if the artist is not there anymore, even if the artist slash activist is not there anymore. Like, for example, we've been going around Cebu the past 2 days. We've been seeing the murals that we painted like 8 years ago, 9 years ago. They're still there. The beauty of nature that we painted are still there. And that's a beauty part. And you don't need language, you know, to speak using visuals. You know, as long as the audience have a pair of eyes, or even just one eye, you can communicate to them the message that you have in your heart. That's the beauty of art. And in this journey, I think more than 65 nationalities, people from more than 65 countries volunteered in painting with us. It didn't matter if they speak Slovakian or Czech or English or Spanish. We just gave them the brush and the paint and gave them the freedom to connect to anyone who would see the walls by painting alongside with us. And that's the beauty of art. And I think Well, I've experienced a lot of other types of activisms or forms of activism. And I think the operative word there is to act, and to plant thousands of mangroves is a form of action. It's a form of activism. To paint a thousand murals is a form of activism. You know, to educate people, to help indigenous people, that's a form of activism. There's so much things that we can do. Perfect. So much. There's like the big spectrum of action that we can work on. Maybe it just so happened that my instinct told me to grab a brush and start painting walls.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one of the things that I'm hearing and I'm feeling myself is this word consistency, you know, that, and the balance and the challenge for us is to commit to something. And I'm not saying this is easy, but I've noticed in myself that when I've done something for 10 years and I can think of three big things that have happened in my life, which I've committed to for 10 years, at the beginning, I didn't know it was going to be 10 years and I didn't know where it was going to end up or not end up. Well, where I would arrive after 10 years, but it's always been bigger and better and more incredible than I might have imagined. But it has also taken time and consistency. So when you started out, did you in any way say, I'm going to paint 1,000? Or was this just the result, as I'm saying, of commitment and time, and it is what it is?
Yeah, I think it's basically a combination of commitment and passion, I would say. Then time became function of it. Like I said, I never really planned on what to happen. I never saw myself doing it for a year.
Yeah.
But then during that time, I had this idea or a dream to paint 100 murals in my lifetime.
Right.
But I didn't know how it would happen. But after 12 years, it's times 10, actually. I had no finance plans. We had no funding, nothing. I just went around knocking on construction sites, asking for spare paint. And when I posted on Facebook that I'll paint one dolphin for every dolphin that they capture in Japan, the idea was just a year, but it went on and went on. I think the value of action is that there's always a reaction.
Yeah.
And probably it became like a positive thing, and one action led to another, and it was embraced by the community, like a global community. Just had to react again to their pleading, to their support, you know, to the value that they put in, or that they consider about my art. So it led from one wall to another and another. So it's like changing the world or changing hearts and minds one wall at a time.
Absolutely, it is. Now, do you remember you set out in 2010 to paint 100? Do you remember when you reached that number 100, which year it was, by any chance?
Yeah, same year, actually. Year.
Oh, so you painted 100 in 1 year? Wow.
Yeah, it was nonstop painting. There were times when I was in an airport, not knowing where I was going, so I had to check my calendar or my boarding pass just to know where I'm going that day. It was intense. It was an intense 1 year.
So tell me something. Okay, so you did 100 in 1 year, and your 1,000 in which year?
2022, November.
22. So that was, is that 12 years later? Just for
12 years later. Years.
And when you hit your 100, did you say, oh, well, I've hit 100 in a year. I'm now going to hit 300 or 500. What was the next goal, if you did, that you set yourself at that time? Do you remember?
That time there was no goal anymore. I just said that every time there's an invitation, I would say yes.
Great.
I kept saying yes and yes. And before I knew it, I was all over the place, all over the world.
Great.
Doing lots and lots of murals.
So if you, by the way, had to give advice to somebody who is sitting in business or in life or something and is being challenged a little bit to think and dream of an extraordinary goal. Because I would say imagining doing 100 murals, if not 1,000 murals, is an extraordinary goal. It could even be a dream for many people because it sounds so difficult. Well, what advice would you give to somebody at that beginning moment when they were just being asked to dream or of something like this?
Well, this might sound like a cliche, but never stop in believing in your dreams. You know, that's what kept me going. At least for the first year, I said I wanted to do 100 murals. Kept me going. But after that, I think the universe gave me back a lot more, you know, because I put in a lot of effort. Sleepless nights, you know, endless travels, uncertainty even. I gave up my job. Never went back to find a job for the past 12 years because of this. Means I've put in a lot of effort. in achieving my dream. You can't dream and just sit down or do nothing about it. I think the best advice would be take the first step towards that dream. And after the first step, things will fall into place if you keep on going, you know. Take the first step. Might be big, might be small, just take it, you know, take the first step.
That is so profound, and I love it. Let me then ask you just to build on this, because it's an important subject for me. Well, I have a view that when you look forward and you say the word 100, it feels incredibly difficult. But then when you get to 100 and you look back, suddenly the mountain seems much smaller, that we can achieve things. And once you've gone on the journey and got there and you look back and say, well, God, it wasn't quite as hard as I imagined. You know, could you talk to me about how you feel in that idea of looking forward and taking the first step, but then looking back and reflecting?
Yeah, what you said is very true. And it really applies to my journey, because when I got to know how one mural can be done, and then it got replicated because there were volunteers, people supporting me, people giving me paint, it actually became easier to finish one wall. You know, sometimes we work on a wall for just a few hours, like a half a day, then we're done. And we end up painting another wall within the day. So I found out that if you look at it like one wall at a time, becomes easy, and the mountain becomes smaller, you know, and it seems that it's not as hard as you thought that you can climb it, you know. Becomes easier if you look at it that way. But if you look at the dream as 100 murals right away, no way, you can't swallow that in one bunch. Like if you dream, for example, of becoming an award-winning filmmaker, I mean, you can't expect that next week you'll be awarded an Oscar, you know. Have to take the first step, get your skills intact, get ready, find out how it's done, you know. Then when I discovered, like I said, it's easy to do one wall if you have supporters, you have friends. I would just draw everything like a coloring book with outlines. And I would ask everyone to pitch in, color this spot, and we do it in a few hours. And it's solved.
Fantastic. You know? It's so refreshing, and I'm so inspired. I'm so delighted to have had this conversation or having this conversation with you, because it's a story that I say a lot, and you've crystallized several of the points. I mean, this idea of if you just do one and you do one at a time, you know, suddenly you will end up at 100. But if you imagine 100 in the beginning, you probably won't start. So I really appreciate you bringing that story to life. Now, the question then is, I've got two. I've got first the difficult question and then the easiest one. The difficult one, let's call it a sensitive one, is, so you said you gave up your job. How are you supporting yourself? Is this something that's become a living for you and is able to support your lifestyle, or is this still something complementary? If I may ask that question, delicate as it is.
Yeah, when I was starting, before I started, I was, well, there's a term that we call OFW, or Overseas Filipino Worker.
Oh, right.
You know how Filipinos are like expatriated all over
the world,
doing all sorts of skills and professions, right? So I was a photographer on a cruise ship owned by Disney for a couple of years, and I earned a lot. I mean, I'm not gonna lie, I earned a lot from that, shooting photographs, selling photographs on the cruise ship. And so I had a lot of savings. Most of them are in dollars, so I had the dollar account, and I was using those savings for many years when I was doing the murals, because I didn't have a regular job. I never charge for the murals. If people would ask me how much do you need, I said no, it's okay, we'll take care of it. Then I had a lot of invitations, had hundreds and hundreds of invitations to speak, to give lectures in universities, in schools, public and even private engagements all over the world. In the beginning, I would say no if they would give an honorarium. I said, no, I'm speaking for Mother Nature. Yeah, that's totally okay. Then at some point, I was already using up all my savings. Not all, but a big part of my savings. Somebody told me, you know what, have you been praying or wishing for, you know, for something to happen that will sustain you? I said, yeah, I ask for that every day. I mean, I ask the universe to bless me with that every day. And then the person said, then you're denying your own prayer if you're rejecting the help, the financial help or the honorarium that people are volunteering to give you. You should start accepting that. And I realized, oh yeah, actually that's true. I started accepting it. Sustained me. It's not really big, but it could pay for my electrical bills, for my water and all, food, of course. But the good thing is that if I get invited to paint anywhere in the world, I get taken care of. I don't spend for my food. People would pay for my transportation, for my living, for my accommodations and all. I actually spend more when I'm home in Manila compared to when I'm away. Yeah, so that sustained me. But still, I don't never had income during those years. But I get to do what I want, to do what I love, because I get sustained financially, or all of the financial needs that are required of me and sometimes my team with me is taken care of by people who want to support the cause and to be part of the effort, the journey.
Well, that's very inspiring and very humbling to also hear the words you're using. And I think you're right. You absolutely have a right, if I may say, to receive those gifts, because two people benefit. You benefit, and of course, the giver benefits. So we have to remember that when you give something as a generosity or whatever, it's not that person gets a lot from it too. And one needs to remember that. Right. So I am sure you do. Now, the other question then is, so is this having an impact? And I think this is an important question, because at the moment in the UK, for example, there is a group and have been stopping the traffic in many roads by gluing themselves to try and bring awareness to the fact that we have to stop consuming so much oil, and we need to insulate our homes and do these things. And it's made people rather angry, but they've done it because they just got so frustrated in the government's not acting when you use logical argument. But they've decided to stop because they've noticed it annoyed lots of people and didn't even change the government. And so the question is, I think, an important one for them, which is how can they be activists so they create change, but didn't do it in a way that affects the people who are the change decision makers, perhaps more. So with yourself, have you got examples of where you think your murals have shifted attitudes and changed behavior, something you feel you've observed?
Yeah, I got a lot of questions related to that even in the beginning. And to be honest, in the first few years, it was quite hard or difficult to answer that question with substance, because there are impacts of art that can't be realized in just a few years. But then, of course, if you talk about participation, I mean, early on, we already had like thousands and thousands of people participating. And that in itself is a victory. It's probably an indication of the success of the movement that we created. But then the real impact is when I would find out that there's this young boy who joined us when he was in elementary school, who's now a marine biologist, because he got inspired by painting dolphins with me. I didn't even remember who he was. Just found out in an event that there's this kid who was saying, he was speaking in front of an audience saying, when I was in high school, there was this artist who painted dolphins in our school. And I think it made an impact on me and my classmates and all. And then I find out also that some of the kids who painted with me like 9 or 10 years ago are now graduate of fine arts with a fine arts degree. And obviously, and admittedly, they said that's AG who gave us the spark, you know, to go into arts. And those for me are the real impact, especially those kids who are using their art for Mother Nature, in the same way as how I showed them many, many years ago. And so, then there's also probably impact on the ground. Because aside from painting, I said I also gave a lot of lectures and inspirational talks. And we also did quite a lot of marine mammal rescue trainings when we do our murals in coastal regions in the Philippines.
Right.
And yeah, it's amazing. It's an amazing feeling to hear that some of the communities that we taught actually did as actual dolphin rescues. And that's part of the journey, part of the mission. Yeah. But for me, the best impact is when people who joined me, whether in the lectures or in painting murals with me, committed to not going to dolphin shows anymore.
Right.
And that for me is the best result.
I want to come back to the people, the individuals who've actually inspired to become marine biologists and illustrators and perhaps photographers. I'm intrigued about the gift that we can give to a younger generation to inspire them to do something and to be really good at it. And the danger is sometimes successful people, you know, one doesn't understand the role of mentoring and coaching that one has the gift to give and one can give. What's your philosophy around that? I'd love to hear that.
Yeah, for me, I always put value in what my mentor gave to me. I'd like to name him. His name is Mr. Senna. Mr. Senna came from a humble family, and then he was so good in art that he would win a lot of national competitions when he was in college. He became famous as a young artist. But when he graduated, he decided to teach the poor Well, he went to the poor communities of Manila, like the slums, and taught them art for free. And he formulated the most basic way of drawing that became so easy to anyone who would hear his mentoring, his lectures. And then my mom enrolled me in his workshop. And immediately we had a bond, and he told me, next year, don't enroll anymore as a student. I'm going to make you my assistant. So at a very early age, I became an assistant of this amazing mentor. And one day, I was cleaning some of his stuff in the studio. Then guy came in with a nice car and then went down and talked to my mentor, Mr. Senna. And I heard them talking. The guy said, can you teach my kids exclusively? I'm going to pay whatever cost or amount you require of me. Then I heard Mr. Senna say, no, I don't do that. I can teach 100 kids who can't pay, and rather than teach like 3 kids who can pay me a big sum, because my goal is to teach, is to share my art, especially to those who can't afford art. And that stuck with me till now. And that was a long time ago. I think I was 13 maybe when that happened, when I heard that. And it stuck with me. And that's my philosophy in mentoring. I would share, especially to the remote areas. And actually, I found myself doing that in conflict areas in the Philippines, like war zones in the southern Philippines, because of the same reason as what I heard from Mr. Sen, or what I learned from Mr. Sen's values as a mentor.
Very, it's extremely moving, isn't it? What he said, and therefore what you're doing, and the gift he gave you, and the gift you're sharing on, it lifts the spirit, because the temptation is to charge, or is to ask for money, or is to only want money, or is to not realize that you can pass a gift to other people, and that gift can then be passed on. I salute you for that tremendously. My last couple of thoughts. So if I was a magician, or if I just had a lucky thing, which was a wand of some sort, and I could hand you a wand that would allow you to achieve a dream that perhaps you still have, or a wish you still have. I only mention that wand as a metaphor just because it allows one to dream a lot. I don't think you have any limitations on the ability to dream great dreams. So, but nonetheless, in this world of sustainability, in this world of the terrible destruction of dolphins still, which are actually more, I think, are killed just in the nets than even killed in Japan, for example. What wish or what dream do you have at the moment that would be wonderful to realize if possible?
Yeah, an easy dream or easy wish would be to stop dolphin deaths over the world. But of course, that's quite a dream. You know, that's probably undoable. Yeah. But for now, I have this crazy dream of painting a dolphin in outer space, so that the world's population will be my audience. Of course, it's a ridiculous idea, but if I could paint a dolphin, like maybe on a paper, on a canvas in outer space, regardless of the carbon footprint, of course. I mean, it's like just to say a crazy dream. I think that will be a performance on a stage that everyone, almost all the world's population, will have their eyes on me, so that I can tell them what I need to tell them about how we can save what's left of the environment.
There are two people you need to send an email to, I would suggest. One is, quite seriously, this is not even a joke, it's Jeff Bezos. Has created this little rocket that is able to take the very, very, very rich just to the outer surface of the world. And I've been incredibly moved by an actor who's now 91, and he was the star of Star Trek.
Oh, yeah, Shatner.
William
Shatner.
And do you know why I'm moved? Because he said, my God, for the first time, he looked out at space and saw that for a million billion miles, there is no other living planet, no other place of all this life. Yeah. You look at the Earth and realize you've got this small capsule, and that we are essentially destroying this thing that is so incredibly unique, that in a million billion planets, of which there are, that we, or stars, we've not found another one. And that profoundness that's affected him means that I think if you were able to somehow write to him or to Jeff Bezos, and by the way, I did once write to Jeff Bezos and he answered me within 6 hours.
Seriously?
I just wrote jeffbezos@amazon.com. And I wrote him a little note, and he answered me. So I wouldn't take away the thought of writing to him directly.
Wow, and never thought there could be.
Because frankly, his rocket is called Blue something. I've forgotten what it's called, but it's also got Blue in the name, if I remember rightly. So I would do that because I would love it to become true. And you never know, it just might.
I never even thought there could be any like inch of possibility to even.
Well, I think there is. I think there is, and I think worth you writing. And I'm going to send you a little clip of this conversation where you say this, Well, you'll see that you'll get the whole thing if you want. But anyway, I'm more than happy to give you a clip of this and attach it to the email and say, look, I was talking about this and I had this dream and we've had an idea and perhaps you can help me, because you may be surprised, or we both may be surprised, and that would be lovely. Mm-hmm. So is there any other thing that you'd like to share with an audience? I mean, it's been a fantastic story. You've had so many motivational things you've said, inspiring. Is there any other thought other than the wonder which we may have cracked an answer that... Any tips or tricks to an audience to how they can make a difference in this world? Because I think sometimes we struggle to know what we could do. Any thoughts?
Yeah, I have so much to say, but I always go down to the simplest thing. You know, segregate at home. Segregate at home. Segregate degradable from the non-biodegradables. Or better yet, throw away your trash can and start segregating, you know, at home. It is probably surprising for some people expecting some grand thing for me to say, but for me, start at home, you know. We can talk about how we can change the world, but if it's something that people would think that's so grand or so hard to do, then they won't take the first step in doing it. But if you will tell them something that they would realize, oh, I could actually do that, then I think that's the most convenient thing or most effective thing to say. So just separate the food waste from your plastic. Right. Start there.
Well, and I have to tell you then, I've just interviewed this morning also, had a podcast with a gentleman also from the Philippines, and his brother invented the term, and he thinks he's invented, and I think it's brilliant, it's called urban mining, which urban means mining. The ability to go into the home and to source the plastic, source the cardboard, source the food and reuse it. And I thought it's probably one of the most inspiring words that I've heard to capture an idea. I give it to you because I think you might appreciate it too.
Yeah.
And I'll put you in contact with him just on email, because I think you may... Well, look, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you so much for your time. And yeah, a great, great conversation.
Thank you. So can I add just one more thought?
Yes.
To anyone who would listen, plant a tree on your birthday. That's it. Plant a tree on your birthday.